Today we conclude our course, Holy Habitations. We will begin with a review of where we've been, and we will end with a consideration of our own church and then our own diocese and our own sort of movement, the continuing Anglican church movement, and how most of our churches are constructed. How did church congregations wind up in these buildings? If we and other churches had the freedom to build their own church, what would it look like? And, you know, various questions to that point. We're not going to be as heavy on content today. And for anyone who's listening on this podcast, you'll have to envision the churches that I show on this screen because it's going to be largely visual. But we will begin with a review. But before that, we shall pray. The Lord be with you. Let us pray. Almighty God, our Heavenly Father, who has committed to thy holy church the care and nurture of thy people, enlighten with thy wisdom those who teach and those who learn, that rejoicing in the knowledge of thy truth, they may worship thee and serve thee from generation to generation, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. All right, so we are going to begin with a review, reminding ourselves of where we've been. We've done a chronological race through human history and sacred space. And we began, if you recall, in the Garden of Eden. In our second session after the introduction, we considered how the Garden of Eden itself, some scholars have noticed, when the topography of the Garden of Eden was considered as it's described in the first books of Genesis, there was something like a structure with a most sacred space, a surrounding kind of holy area, and then the rest of creation. We noticed that this, let's say, original sacred temple was given to Adam and Eve, and especially Adam was given the instruction to care for this place in the same words that were used later in the Old Testament to describe instructions given to the priests who were to care for the temple, basically to till and keep it. Those words are repeated for the Levitical ministry, to till and keep this tabernacle, this temple. So we start in the very outset of creation with the notion of sacred space. And even within the center of that sacred space, there was a tree of life. And this tree, of course, reappears in the last book of the Bible in Revelation. And we can't go all the way through all that theology, but nevertheless, we've got full circle in the scriptures, that sacred space. Of course, after sin is introduced into the world and essentially the lack of goodness is introduced, a distance from God, a death is introduced into that relationship, we have a new sacred space that eventually is introduced to the people of God, but there is now a level of sacrifice that is not simply worship, but is atonement. Atonement is introduced to the notion of the tabernacle and the temple, which both have these altars outside where sacrifice is to be made, because there has become a separation caused by sin between God and man. Nevertheless, God makes his presence local in this movable tabernacle and in this permanent, let's say, quasi-permanent temple in Jerusalem. And there was a vision there of heaven in that tabernacle and in that temple. A restored Eden was hinted at in that sacred space. And there was a vision of heaven then for sojourners who are out in the wilderness, who are wandering hither and yon. And there was a vision of heaven for royalty, when Jerusalem is established as a city of David, and you've got now kings. King Saul did not have that temple. King David saw what that temple was going to be, but Solomon was the one who built the temple. And so now this sacred space is in existence, communicating not only that God is making a dwelling with us, but that there is progress to be made in the spiritual life, and there is also a holy of holies, a temple not made with hands, of which this temple is only the copy. That sacred space communication begins in Eden, continues in the tabernacle and in the temple. Of course, the temple is destroyed in 586 by the Babylonians and King Nebuchadnezzar. It is gingerly rebuilt you read the account of it in Ezra and Nehemiah. And by the time of the first century, by the time of Christ and the incarnation, the Roman Empire is taken over, and King Herod, who is half Jewish, wishes to placate the people that he has come to rule through that Roman Empire by really establishing and beefing up this temple. But when Christ comes, he fulfills the temple, he fulfills the priesthood, he fulfills the sacrifice, and he speaks of that temple saying, the temple will be torn down and I'll rebuild it in 3 days. And that's as offensive a thing as can be said at that time, especially to the Sadducees, to the Pharisees and scribes and lawyers. They didn't understand what he was talking about. But when he rose from the dead after 3 days in the tomb, now we understand he is the temple. He is the great high priest. He is the altar. He is the sacrifice. And we know that essentially he is the sacred space. I don't want to get too weird, but but let's just say that too. And so when churches begin to meet, they don't have the freedom to build giant cathedrals or to imitate the temple in that way. They just basically need a place to come in out of the rain and a place where they perhaps won't be spotted by Romans who are willy-nilly persecuting the Christian church, depending on who's the emperor of the day. And so the house church begins. This is exactly what it sounds like. A church meeting at a house. 1 second, Joe. And then after the house church, that first generation, the church starts to say, well, why don't we buy a house and refurbish the house to look more like what we need it to be rather than meeting at Larry's house? You know, okay, they live there. So let's buy a house and we'll tear this wall down and build this thing up, and it'll be more like a church. That's the church house. Once again, a church for sojourners, those that don't quite yet have a home. They're not quite welcome in this place. We find a pattern repeating. Joe, you had a question?
Would that lend itself to the church being called a sanctuary that some denominations are apt to do?
Well, the sanctuary denotes the holiest place. Place that is sanctuary, as I understand, means is a place that is set apart, but it is made holy. The reason that other churches later will call the entire room the sanctuary is that they have basically discarded the theology that the sacramental presence of Christ is in the room. And so you don't need to distinguish between the sanctuary and the nave. The whole thing is the sanctuary, because we don't believe in that, you know. So that's why whole churches, the entire worship space is called the sanctuary in some churches, but in churches like ours, the sanctuary is within the altar rail. So we're denoting sort of a fulfillment of the Old Testament with the Holy of Holies, and then the holy place, and then the outer courts. You can still see that in the way our churches are built. But these house churches, they don't have the freedom to do that yet. And so they first of all meet in so-and-so's house. Secondly, they buy a house together. They get their money together. They buy a house. They tear down a wall. They refurbish it. But still, the church are sojourners. But when Constantine comes along and becomes the emperor, and then becomes the emperor of the entire empire, not just I think he was the West first, and then he was the West and the East in 324. The church has the freedom and the money and the power now to build whatever they want to build. And that's the first time in the fourth century when you start to see churches being built like this. The Hagia Sophia is built, okay? Constantine would also build St. Peter's in Rome. He would also build the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. What was the other one? There was the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. All of these massive churches were built, and they were built in a style to welcome an emperor, a basilica. Basileus means emperor. They were designed to be basically a royal house, a royal place of worship. Of course, we're welcoming in not only the emperor, but the King of Kings into this place. So it's fitting to have the basilica in that way. And you remember, now that we get into the fourth century, we're starting to see when the church has its druthers and has the choice to build what it wants to build, the theology starts to seep through into the construction itself. You have sort of a wondrous and mystical dome, a famous dome in the Hagia Sophia that seems to hover on light itself. There's something mystical and, let's say, upward directing. There is a suggestion of ascent in the Christian life. When you walk, I've never been to the Hagia Sophia, but when you walk in, apparently you cannot help it. The first thing you do is look up when you get in there. You just can't believe. I mean, everyone's seen a large floor space room, but not everyone's had a room this high with a magnificent, impossible work of architecture above them in this dome. So it causes you to look up. And before there was Arabic all over the central part of the dome, there was an image of Christ there. And so that style, that design has been imitated many, many times since then, especially in the Eastern churches, the dome with Christ at the center. But now this is not a church for sojourners. This is a church for kings. This is for emperors. This is people that run this place. Okay? That all works very well until the barbarians take over, or let's say crash Rome and shake things up a little bit in the world. Not long after that, the church starts to rethink how we ought to be building. The abbey is developed. If you remember, the abbey looked a lot more like a fortress than a church. We need a place to hunker down. And in the type of construction that they were building those early abbeys in, they looked like fortresses with parapets at the top where you could shoot an arrow through, and windows that were so small that an invader couldn't get through. Windows that were high up, so you'd have to scale a wall to get in, and people were generally safe in the enclosure. Just that whole idea of being enclosed in a walled compound was a concern in those early medieval centuries of the church. But as the medieval era continued, we worried less about foreign invasion and literally being overtaken by marauding bands. We had, in the beginning of the second millennium, some real architectural advances, so that what we see here in the Hagia Sophia with these small Roman arches that are able to span smaller spaces. Now, this is a magnificent architectural feat, but it's not a normal one. But you can definitely see the Roman arches there. What's developed later, I think, yep, I got to go through every single one of these to get to the next slide. In the late medieval ages, a very simple architectural design is invented, the Gothic arch, which allows that center point to bear much more weight. So the larger you make the arch, it's all right. It's not going to collapse in the center. The two sides of the arch are meeting at that high point. You could make wide rooms now more commonly than... I probably shouldn't use the Hagia Sophia because it's kind of an exception. But nevertheless, you start to see these Gothic cathedrals and great churches. A cathedral, of course, is where the bishop is. And with these pillars supporting all these Gothic arches, you find that sense, which I really liked, the idea of the church has become like a forest again. Oftentimes the altar is behind a screen or behind something that obfuscates your vision. You can't quite see what's going on at the front, and you feel lucky to catch a glimpse of what's going on. It's as if what's being communicated about the Christian faith is that while there is progress, you're going to progress down the center aisle to receive of God yourself, you're going to have to search for him through a forest, something like an Eden, to see as you're walking through the garden. Perhaps you'll meet God walking in the garden too. You'll meet him walking in the forest. But something of that idea of hardly being able to even see what is going on at the front of the church eventually is something that is, let's say, reacted against. And the rood screens, which are screens that sort of make it hard to see, rood screens are oftentimes removed towards the end of the late medieval era, the Renaissance and the Reformation, when we're going back now to the sources. We're going back to the Roman and to the Greek culture. We're going back to the... We're dropping the Gothic arches now because we've figured out how more commonly to make giant Roman arches, and to recall our classical history. The Renaissance is all about this. And the Reformation is also rejecting this idea of a difficult to see altar. We want everything pushed aside because the church is more of a, let's say, it has become, the clerical lay divide has become too wide. We need to shorten this up. The clergy and the lay people are not that far as these churches communicate. In fact, in many Protestant churches, they eliminate it so much that there's no difference between the clergy and the laity at all. In the most extreme form, if I'm not mistaken, I'm not speaking out of school, the Mennonites would draw names out of a hat for who would be the pastor this year. If I'm not mistaken, it's the Mennonites, one of them, I know that. I think it was the followers of Menno, the Mennonites, who so didn't believe in the ordained ministry that they just chose the pastor for the year, and whoever you were, once your year was up, you're out. It reminds me of Monty Python. We're an anarcho-syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to be act as a sort of governor, and every 2 weeks, bi-week, okay, yeah. So anyway, yeah, once you've rejected the notion of the priesthood, you don't need so much an ordained minister. You just need someone who can talk. Now, after the Reformation, we covered an Anglican and evangelical, I call them fire churches, because on the Anglican side, after the restoration of the monarchy in the end of the 17th century, right in the after, well, let's say 1660s, there was a fire in London that burned, I think what I read was 90 churches were burned to the ground, which is a terrible thing unless you'd like to rebuild churches. And then it's a great thing. So they hired this guy named Christopher Wray, who was given the freedom to design and develop and build dozens of churches in the London area, and sort of began some styles of church design that we still see in, let's say, on this street. You can see churches that were influenced by Christopher Wray. I want to say that Methodist church right over there has pillars on the front. Yeah, so it's designed in the way that we're gonna that we talk about the Parthenon church with the steeple. So Christopher Wray, though,
Ray.
Wren. I'm sorry. Who am I talking about? FBI. That's right. It's on the brain, so. Wren. Yes, so for anyone listening to this a year from now. Yeah, Christopher Wray is the FBI outgoing head. I'm talking about Christopher Wren. Thank you very much. The guy with the big white wig. That's the guy I'm talking of. Anyhow, Christopher Wren. His design, though, incorporates, in a very Anglican way, a church design that welcomes the historical faith, but eliminates just what needs to be eliminated from the accretions of the late medieval era. In other words, the pulpit is not hidden, the pulpit is brought forward. That's a pretty good idea. And I'm with him on the idea that the rood screen should be pulled away so that you can see what's going on within the altar rail. The altar rail being lowered and being essentially invisible too. You can see right through the distance between the high altar and the congregation is shrunk down. And there's a lot of good that's communicated there in that sort of, I don't know if you'd call it quintessentially Anglican style, but it is a style that is imitated a bazillion times from the 17th century onwards. But evangelical fire churches, I will say, is once the evangelical style of outdoor tent revivals and basically the outdoor preaching of the Great Awakening that brought in so many thousands of people to hear these fiery sermons that were being preached. Once they were done getting rained on, someone said, we should have a shelter. But a shelter that looks like a camp meeting. Shelter that looks like one of these revivals. And you recall all those buildings that were much, much more like auditoriums. Sometimes with the pulpit raised very, very high. Sometimes with the altar or sacramental elements basically eliminated. Now with the congregation facing each other, so they had the ability to see each other's spiritual experiences and even have space down in the front for, you know, even wilder things to happen down there. We know churches that are like that as well. But that design becomes a part of the Christian world, let's say 18th century is more common, right around that neighborhood. 19th century as well. But there was a restoration of London and then an embrace of history and a renewal, both for the Anglican world and for the evangelical world as well. We then talked about the current era. You know, we're talking 19th and 20th, 21st centuries. And there is essentially a polarization between historicism, which is, of course, the embrace of historical structures. And we think about the 19th century construction of St. Patrick's in New York that looks like it came right out of the 11th century. This fantastic Gothic church, a modern construction embracing a historical ideology. And then the modernist churches, which felt that to embrace such a historical style was something like atheism. You know, to say, well, you know, we know that God existed in the 12th century, but does he exist in the 21st century? And shouldn't our churches look like the 21st century? And so they try to make churches that look like the 21st century, and they start to look, they start to reduce ornamentation. They start to increase sort of the industrialized feel, lots of concrete, lots of focus on materials, sparseness, and sometimes an emphasis on just natural light or shapes, you know. But the building itself wasn't communicating so much anymore, wasn't communicating so much theology. And sometimes it was communicating chaos. You remember the Notre Dame, not the cathedral, but the other one in France that I showed you that looked like something out of Super Mario, like a giant mushroom. What is it called? Notre Dame du Haut or something like that. I can't think of the name. Ronchamp is the name of the town. They just call the church Ronchamp. But anyhow, that type of idea is something like a postmodern philosophy communicated in a church. The people all sit on the right side, not the left. The windows are all disordered. The roof is concave, or it's the roof is like coming in on you rather than lifting your eyes upward. And it makes you want to close your eyes. Makes you want to close your eyes and pray because there's nothing to look at. I mean, it may be an architectural wonder, but anyhow. And so we see in the 19th, 20th, 21st century, both an embrace of the past and a fleeing of the past. And you can see that. Just drive around Greenville. You can see those ideas. And so we look at our setting, a simple Anglican church. That's definitely what we got here. Thomas Merton, opining that it was absurd for modern congregations to get a Gothic church out of a small budget, argued that it was far better to put up something that would give glory to God and would be very simple and would also be in the tradition of our fathers. And I say, hey, that's what we have. So we have a church here that is very simple, that when it was originally built in the year 2000, didn't break the bank. It also didn't blow anyone's mind. It's a rectangle with a roof to keep the rain off. You know, a steep roof, so it gives you something, there's something ascendant about the room when you walk in. The refurbishment of the church in 2017, where the stained glass window was put in, really helped because it changed the light in the room. Light is now coming in from the east. And though the actual project was the organ, the window is what everyone looks at, you know, because, oh my goodness, this room feels different. That's a good thing. We've added some iconography to give more of a theological message to this sacred space. But in the end, we do embrace the tradition of our fathers, as Thomas Merton says. This is not a postmodern church or a church where we're fleeing from the past. Well, we're not fleeing from the present either. But nevertheless, that's what we have here. The reality, I'm going to say, in most continuing Anglican churches, we begin by meeting in homes, libraries, gymnasiums, and eventually in our own small buildings. And we consider the history of St. George the Martyr. If you've read if you're going to read, has that been sent out yet, the summary? Not yet. Okay, so very soon you'll receive something that has a brief history of St. George as one of the Strategic Planning Committee's packet. There's a little brief history there. And it shows that this church originally met in various different places, but started at the YMCA, and then eventually met in other spaces before we could build this here. And then eventually the parish hall was built in 2005. So it takes time. But continuing Anglicanism is something like that pattern recurring again of sojourners to kings. There's a time for sojourners and we're in it. But we're not meeting in a strip mall, and we're not meeting in the YMCA anymore. We're moving towards kingdom. We're still a little bit of sojourner. So most of our churches, this is not a scientific number, but I'm going to guess from what I know of the APA at least. Maybe Father Suter can help me with this. Perhaps 70% of our churches meet in buildings that were originally designed for another denomination, another theology, and we've learned to make do. So a lot of times the buildings that we purchase are, you know, a Methodist church or a Presbyterian church or an old Baptist church, and the priest has to come in and go, what can we do to make this more Anglican? It's a common struggle. If you think about St. Matthew's Church in Weaverville, it's a beautiful historic church. This is where Father Kimbrell is now. But this was not designed to be an Anglican church. It was, I think, originally a Presbyterian church. The building is more than 100 years old. It's a wonderful building. But you notice a couple of awkward things, that if an Anglican priest was designing this church, he wouldn't have done that. Well, they have to make do. For instance, if you have to use the restroom, you have to walk basically past the altar to go to, and that makes it awkward. the sacristy is also up by the altar, or the vesting room, and the sacristy. So when the clergy are ready to process, they have to walk back past the people and then back up through the center, which is a little awkward. It's not really a problem. It's just, you see how we kind of make do. Also, our churches like ours refurbish and repurpose. So we're looking now, eventually we'll see a larger picture of St. Patrick's in Brevard. Many of our parishes have made significant investment in refurbishing and renovating buildings and parish furniture to encourage worship of the Lord with the embrace of historical traditions, especially from the 17th century, the Anglican sort of restoration and prior, late medieval. But they've taken something that had nothing to do with church and made it into a church. St. Patrick's in Brevard purchased a warehouse that was used. It was a dance hall at one point, and then it was I shouldn't say dance hall. I can't remember what it was. Something to do with ballet or something like that. But then it became a mattress warehouse. Yeah. Then they purchased the mattress warehouse, but they were in the basement of an office building. Well, if you'd rather, you know, the basement of the office building was basically, it needed to be expanded. They would never grow. So they purchased this building that is like a warehouse style. But on the back, they put a steeple. They've developed the parking lot. They've put up a sign out by the road. They've got a flag flying. And inside, it looks like this. You know that does not look like a mattress warehouse. These people have been working on this. And this reredos at the back of the altar was just built, completed, and blessed by the bishop very recently. And so, you know, that's part of our world. When we're looking at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, okay, that took $1 billion to restore. Just restore, okay. Back up. So we're looking at churches in our diocese. Here's St. Matthias in Dothan, Alabama, as they were designing it just a few years ago. The idea of building new. Other of our parishes have been blessed to grow in number and finances enough to build new churches according to their own design. And each of these churches began humbly, increased in size gradually with various steps of faith. There are no Anglican megachurches. When you're searching for one, you won't find it. You remember when we began to discuss megachurches last week, Bill Hybels, when he had his first successful megachurch, he was able to make that broad appeal by making it not look like a church and by removing from the building all religious signs and symbols, all signals that this was a church. And that's how it grew. We ain't that. Not interested in doing anything like that. So if you want to be a mega church, you got to kind of do that. And we're not going to do that. So we're not going to be a mega church. This type of church only appeals to a certain type of person or a person that's a certain place in their spiritual life. So we're going to consider some designs these are churches within our diocese and one that's outside of our diocese but in our tradition. So we're looking at Dothan, Alabama. This is a design that came to fruition just a few years ago. But you can see how we're incorporating, and even this church, we've got these Gothic little arch windows. They incorporate a Trinitarian symbol with three Gothic arches. Each of their windows is also that sort of Gothic now. There's nothing necessary about this Gothic arch. It's not holding a great weight on it. It's a signal of what we believe and where we're coming from. So you would never mistake this for a dentist office. You would never mistake it for the bowling alley. It's certainly a church. We're not removing all of the signals and signs that this is a church. We're intentionally including them. We're putting crosses and arches and all of that. This church, by the way, was designed to eventually be the parish hall, so that while they're building the larger church, they have a place to worship, but it's already offices and kitchen and all that kind of stuff. There's a long way to go for them, but that's kind of what I'm communicating, is most of our churches start small, hang out at a particular stage for a long time, get their act together, and then do the next thing. Here's St. Michael the Archangel Church in Matthews, North Carolina, not far from us. They have the best stained glass windows, I will say. That's my opinion. But you can see what they've incorporated here. Once again, the Gothic arch, the red door, the bell tower. You know, these aren't Gothic arches, but nevertheless, they help to communicate that same idea. You've got the rose window developed just under 1,000 years ago in the church. And you would not mistake this for a bowling alley either. This is certainly a church, and you'd get the sense that this was a little traditional Anglican church, perhaps. From the inside and from the balcony in the back, this is what the church looks like. I want you to notice that their pews would only sit about 4 people across, maybe 5. But their church is longer than ours in a sense, and it's definitely in a cruciform shape. You see the low altar rail. Nothing in the altar is hidden. The windows are there for everyone's edification. And the altar is raised. There's 1 step up into the sanctuary and then 2 steps up to the altar, totaling 3 steps. A fantastic design. Also, the Father Bakley, who has helped with the design of this, put little air vents in right there so that the priest would not melt at the altar. So a priest was involved in this. Thank you. Yes. But this is a typical, let's say post-Reformation style Anglican idea of these exposed beams. You'll find this in a number of traditional Anglican churches. All Saints Anglican Church in Charlottesville, Virginia. They have I couldn't find a good picture of their church during the day from the outside, but this is a window leading, the altar is right beneath this window, as you'll see in the next picture. They have a long history in Charlottesville, Virginia. Their church is doing exceptionally well, and they're sort of bursting at the seams too. They have these pews that would fit about 4 or 5 people, and when they're full, they're full. But nevertheless, you see they've got the 1 Gothic arch and the 2 classic icons, which are real icons, painted, drawn, written, however you want to say it, icons. But it's a beautiful little chapel, even smaller than St. Michael the Archangel. But once again, the same sort of visible, open style. There's something like cruciform. I'm not sure that this transept goes out anywhere that direction, but no stained glass. You can see the mountains when the light is right. It's a beautiful little church. The smoke is the incense. I think someone thought it was cool that there was incense, but you know, one of their services looks like this. That would be an Easter Day service, I'm sure of it. St. Barnabas Anglican Church in Dunwoody. This is the church that I came here from. This church was originally this. You see where the little red line is? It was originally just that. That's it. That was the whole church. That's when they started. When I first visited this church, that was it. And then this was built on. And then this was built on. And just recently this was finished. But they started as using a little Presbyterian church. And I've got a picture, which it's now the parish hall. But you'll see that this church, which was built, I'm going to say it was a 2006 or so, was constructed finally. Someone left some money to the church. They were able to start an endowment and a building fund, and they wound up with this. You see the exposed beams again, the low altar rail. The some would say that the pulpit should be on the other side, but anyhow. The organ over here, the choir up here, almost cruciform, but a little side chapel over here. Tray lighting and you know, basically your rose window, your basic, typical standard Anglican church design. But once again, it started with a little tiny Presbyterian church that's now the parish hall. And you see those sort of, those old school 60s or 70s compressed beams that they used to do. But that room was it. That was the original church. The altar was right here, and these were all pews. You could fit, you know, 50, 60 people in there. Ruth?
I'm just curious. I noticed the one in Charlottesville has a blue carpet, and the one in Atlanta has a red carpet. And I'm just wondering, I've always understood the red being symbolic of the blood of Christ.
Yeah.
That's not a uniformity within.
I've never talked to Father Spencer about that. I don't know the answer.
I mean, yeah. I'm
good
with blue.
Blue is typically a Marian color, so there may have been something there about Mary, but it could have been that the vestry just liked blue, and that was that.
Okay.
I'm going to guess that Father Spencer had a theological idea behind it. He's a great theologian, so... So that's St. Barnabas in Atlanta, not far from here. Here's one from outside our realm a little bit, but St. Matthew's in Newport Beach in California. And you can see this is on California, something like a mission style, I would say, like a modern sort of mission style. Not lots and lots and lots of windows, but this could almost be made of adobe or something like that, you know, that kind of style. And you see this looks, I would say, pretty... like a standard medieval high altar, very beautiful. But another classic design, stone floor. I think that may be a treated concrete floor and a stone tile altar area. Plenty of room. Light comes in from the sides. It's beautiful. It's a lovely Anglican church. It's where Bishop Stephen Scarlett is the bishop there. So that's a cathedral church. This is St. Mark's Anglican Church in Vero Beach, Florida, and it's sort of the unattainable goal. Most churches will look at St. Mark's and say, "What in the world? How did you do that?" There are unintended consequences of having a church this beautiful, which Father Mike Ward has told me about. People call this the castle church in the community, and they want to have their picture taken at the castle church. So graduations, weddings, quinceañeras, everybody wants to come on the property and spill all over the place and take pictures in front of their church. Unintended consequence. But nevertheless, the design, once again, on the inside, looks very familiar, doesn't it? You've got Gothic arches, you have exposed beams. I've got another picture here from the altar, the raised pulpit. So we're including that idea that the sermon is not pushed to the side because only the sacrament matters. There's the Word of God as well, a lectern to read the epistle on the other side. You can't fit 500 people in there, but you might fit 200. What's capacity? 225. Yeah, and it's a church that's built in a cruciform shape. They've got pews over here and on the other side as well. But anyhow, this is another church. All of these churches in the Anglican province of America have been founded and established since the 70s. And so when you look at these churches and say, well, we started really in earnest in the 90s, well, then you can say some of these churches that are so well established are about 20 years ahead of us. Okay, or maybe 10 years ahead of us. So when we look at ourselves and we see that we're not in a droopy little city, we're in a pretty great city. We've got a lot of potential for growth here. Is it going to happen this afternoon? Probably not this afternoon. But if we get our act together in about 10 years, we can have a pretty pretty amazing church here too. And we have a fantastic story already. But anyway, that's basically what I wanted to bring to your attention as we conclude our larger study on holy habitations. And I ended way too late last time, and we're right at the end now. But are there any questions or comments? Yeah, Frank, please.
Father Kimbrell's church.
Father Kimbrell's church, yep.
Beautiful country setting, and this looks idyllic.
Yep.
When you just look at it and say, I need to go there.
Mm-hmm. It's great. A lot of these churches, the benefit of these kind of beautiful but simple designs is they naturally draw you to them. You just want to go there, and you just want to see what's in this place. I want to see what it's like in there. And if you go in and you see a massively ornate medieval cathedral where you can't see anything, there's gold everywhere, you say, I think this isn't for me, you know. But a church like that, you say, I think I get it. I understand this. It's more sacred than my house, for sure. But I have not stepped into the Vatican here either. And so, Mary? Yeah, not as often.
Is that not an Anglican tradition?
It is, but it's money. Yeah. And oftentimes real estate. You can't put the transept on that side because that's where the kitchen is, or that's where we have to put this here. The parking lot comes right up to there. So a lot of times, like St. Barnabas is hemmed in with their acre, like whatever acre and a half that they have. They don't have much room. There's no room to go anywhere else. And so St. Mark's has a little bit more room. There's a transept there, but it's not a giant transept, you know what I mean? So, but anyhow, I think that's enough for... Oh, Gene?
No, I was just wondering about, you know, as I look at these, I see Catholic influence, like
right.
This one.
Yeah.
Well, it's not a rose window. It's a standard Catholic,
right.
Catholic window.
Yeah.
You know, in the front there. And then I see Celtic crosses.
Yep.
And I see crucifixes.
Yep.
Celtic cross, Presbyterian, you know, not Anglican, really.
Well, that's arguable, yeah. You know, Celtic, Scottish, I suppose you could say. But it's not that far from the English heritage. This church has a Celtic cross on the top and used to have a Celtic cross over the altar. So that sort of the Celtic ideas, it pervades some of our Anglican churches too. But you do find a little bit of freedom. I really need to stop. It was too long last week. But next week is the greening of the church. No Sunday school. And we have a break for the new year.